Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're talking to Julie Rehmeyer, the author of Through the Shadowlands. Julie is a science writer, an MIT-trained mathematician, so she's very, very science-oriented. But she had to range far afield from modern conventional medicine and science to find an answer to her puzzling chronic fatigue syndrome, which pretty near completely debilitated her. And we're following on her path to recovery. Okay, so in part one, you got onto at least one component of your problem, is that you were mold sensitive. Now, it strikes me that chronic fatigue syndrome comprises some individuals who are mold sensitive, but that's not the end-all and be-all. That's, you know, to propose this as a solution for everyone suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome would be simplistic. Is it possible that what we're dealing with are chronic fatigue syndromes, where maybe there are different paths to recovery for different patients? Some patients responding well to mitochondrial support with supplements, other patients having issues with diet or diet modification is helpful, other patients requiring hormone support, or a combination of above to get well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely true. So at this point, we don't really know if chronic fatigue syndrome is one illness or many. And it's not entirely clear whether, like, that may even be a question of perspective.
Right.
In any case, the basic reigning theory about the illness is that there are a variety of physiological insults that add up, and the result is that something breaks in the body. And what that key something is still unclear. It's recent research suggests that mitochondrial function is a central component in any case. Whether it's the whole story or not isn't so clear. But the particular insults that added up to bring about that break do vary from one patient to another. And it's also the case that figuring out how to undo it varies from one patient to another. Mm-hmm. You know, even so, like getting rid of mold, well, that's a good thing to do, to get rid of continuing mold exposures, but that may or may not be enough to restore function. You know, the mold exposures may have caused lasting damage that doesn't just go away once you get rid of the mm-hmm. mold exposure. So from a clinical point of view, it's really important to tease out the particular components that are affecting the patient that's in front of you and not assume that there's going to be a simple recipe that applies to everybody.
Indeed. And so was that the end of the saga for you? You eliminated mold, you lived out in the desert, you got away from places that might cause triggering events for you.
Right. And then I got dramatically better amazingly quickly. A week after I got back from Death Valley, I was sitting on my land, just, you know, kind of breathing the good air outside where I live, and decided to take my dog for a little walk, figuring I wouldn't be able to go very far. Well, I ended up climbing to the top of the hill behind my house, which is about 350 feet high.
Hmm.
And I hadn't been able to do that for a year and a half.
Wow.
And it absolutely blew my mind. I took a picture of the view from up there. I live outside Santa Fe, so the view was across the entire Rio Grande Valley. I took that picture and I emailed it to all my friends with the subject line, "Oh my God."
Yeah,
because it was absolutely. It was the first indication that doing this was actually going to make me better. You know, I had had indications that exposures could make me worse, but I didn't know whether I would actually get better. So it was an incredibly exciting moment. The story doesn't end there, though, because although I did get dramatically better amazingly quickly, the process of avoiding mold is actually extremely difficult because so many buildings are moldy. And essentially, I had to kind of train my body to be a mold meter. And this was a fascinating process for me. I was kind of amazed by it. So early on, well, before I went to Death Valley, I had no idea. You know, I never went into a building and suddenly felt much worse. I hadn't a clue when I was in a moldy building and when I wasn't, which kind of makes sense because everything I owned basically was steeped in mold. Mm-hmm. And so I was exposed all the time, and, you know, a little extra didn't really make a difference. Well, after the Death Valley trip, initially when I went into a moldy building, the signals were very subtle. It was not a big dramatic thing. I would go in and just, you know, I'd feel a slight pressure in the head or some, you know, even at times it was like, I don't know why I think this isn't good, but I don't think this is good. Mm-hmm. And by focusing on those tiny sensations and then getting out right away, and I'd wash my face and change my shirt, that kind of thing, what I found was that the sensation actually got stronger. Mm-hmm. It was really like developing a sixth sense. It was the most amazing thing. And over time, then it was quite clear when I went into a moldy building. I mean, in fact, kind of too much so. You know, I would go into a moldy building and get crippled.
So in the book, you consulted someone who had the observation that this was akin to something that we all learned about in Psych 101, you know, when we first studied it in college, which is mm-hmm. operant conditioning. In other words, you know, like Pavlov's right. dogs in reverse, instead of salivating at the prospect of a meal, your body went into meltdown at the slightest suggestion that there was mold. And this is not like, oh, you know, you're a hypochondriac. This is actually sort of a brain circuit that...
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that gets sort of inculcated and reinforced, and unfortunately leads to, you know, it's like a bad golf swing. It just gets worse and
right.
worse.
That's exactly right. So it was kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it was very important that I learned to detect mold so that I could get out of there and keep myself safe. And, you know, my body really did need a break in order to heal. At the same time, I was training my brain to react more and more and more by focusing on these tiny signals and making a really big deal about them. Mm-hmm. So I ended up feeling like I've got to find some way of breaking this cycle so that, you know, I want to know, but I don't want to have it be a devastating meltdown at the tiniest exposure. And I took many approaches, and I describe all of this in the book. But one of the approaches was actually inspired by training my dog.
Okay.
So when I met my husband a few months after I got back from Death Valley, my now husband, and he had a cat and I had a dog, and my dog knew exactly what to do with cats. You chase them and it's really fun.
So
we had to train my dog to, you know, how to behave with cats. And so we would have them on opposite sides of a baby gate. My husband would appear with the cat in his arms a good distance away. I'd be on the other side of the baby gate with my dog, and I would immediately start cramming cheese in her mouth. And we did this over and over. And then at some point, I waited just a moment before giving her the cheese. And by this time, she had learned the pattern. Mm-hmm. And so
don't attack the cat is associated right. with a pleasurable experience of getting cheese.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah. Instead of sea cat brain explosion, mm-hmm. it was sea cat cheese.
Okay.
So I'd sort of created a new neural circuit in her brain.
Yeah.
And then I could use that mm-hmm. Over time
right.
to kind of, you know, expand that outward.
But that might not work on you because cheese is moldy, so maybe it's not a good idea for you.
Well, cheese is not – and also is not quite as exciting for me
right.
as for my dog. But then the question was, okay, what was my version of cheese? And I thought about anything that would reach my neurological system. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I would expose myself to mold at a mild level, you mm-hmm. know, not so much to completely freak my body out, but enough that I felt it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did basically anything I could think of that would calm my body down. So I would do yoga, I would meditate, I would put on fun music and dance, you know, anything that would kind of put my neurological system in a totally different state. And over time, I was able to then have the exposures be stronger and not have my body react. So I managed to get the reactions down to a reasonable state.
Wow. Excellent. Now, at one point, what we're going to do now is let's pause for a moment because we want to give one of our sponsors an opportunity to share a message with us. And when we return, we'll continue with your saga, your odyssey into an illness that science doesn't understand. Let's hear now from one of our sponsors.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com.
Thank you very much for listening. And back to our guest, Julie Rehmeyer, author of Through the Shadowlands. As a result of all your research and all your personal experience with chronic fatigue syndrome, you became quite an advocate for patients with CFS. Clearly, there's not enough research money allocated to this, but maybe because it just doesn't lend itself to a quick fix. I mean, everybody's looking for an antibiotic or an antiviral or some sort of remarkable immune modulator or PEP pill that can help cure all patients with chronic fatigue. But what if they're a heterogeneous group? There are many different solutions, and it may require a variety of measures to get patients better. That's the crux of the problem,
right?
Isn't it?
Yeah, that's certainly a major component of it. What I also think it's more that we need a simple story we can fit in our minds. Like with multiple sclerosis, we don't have any kind of great solution, single solution for multiple sclerosis either. We have some things that work for some people some of the time. But in the case of multiple sclerosis, we have a story because we can look at scans of multiple sclerosis mm-hmm. patients and we can see the demyelination of their nerve fibers. So we've got this image that we can hold and we feel like we know what's going on. With chronic fatigue syndrome, we have not yet gotten to that point. We don't have a simple story we can hold in our minds. And you know, to some extent we don't have it just because we haven't done the research. You know, it takes work to find that. When before we had scans, multiple sclerosis was often viewed as being psychosomatic just the same way that chronic fatigue syndrome is now. So it wouldn't surprise me if with increased research, we were able to get a simple story that had a kind of power that got us beyond the kind of fix that we're in right now. And in a funny way, even if that story doesn't explain everything or doesn't take us that far, I think having it would be really transformative in changing attitudes about the illness.
I think the answer may lie in what's called proteomics, because there's not a single blood test that reveals the presence of chronic fatigue syndrome, but more and more through artificial intelligence and computing power, doctors are able to aggregate panels of tests, maybe, you know, 15,
yes.
20 or more tests, and they can discern patterns that wouldn't be detected by a human, but could be detected by
right.
a Watson-like computer. And then they could say, well, your likelihood of having chronic fatigue syndrome is very high based on a composite of your test scores. I think that that's where this is going. And thus, the disease will be diagnosable. Fewer doctors will say, hey, you know, you're just depressed. I mean, how's your marriage? You know,
right.
you're getting along with your parents. You know, what was it like in childhood? You know, it goes psychosomatic theories of
right.
chronic fatigue, where, you know, clearly there's a depressive component, because when you feel as, you know, you can't climb a set of stairs, you're going to feel depressed. I mean, it's
right.
it's the effect, not the cause.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And actually, you know, I think you're really onto something there in talking about the direction things will be going. And there's some really exciting research along those lines by a researcher who also has an amazing story. So Ron Davis of Stanford, who was one of the leaders of the Human Genome Project, his son has a severe case of ME-CFS. And his son is so sick, in his bedroom, unable to communicate for years. And he wears headphones because sounds hurt him. He can't be touched. Mm. He basically can't get out of bed. It's really a state that's like beyond most people's worst nightmares. So Ron Davis is trying to save his son. And because he's a very, very high-powered researcher, he's trying to do that by trying to crack this disease. And he can't get NIH funding because of all of the political problems around chronic fatigue syndrome. So he's actually raising all the money privately. And he's approaching it in exactly the way that you described. So he's, first of all, he's studying the severely ill patients like his son, who have actually never been studied before because they are too sick to travel to a clinic.
Mm.
So he's sending, you know, nurses in to where the patients are, and he's collecting all kinds of bodily fluids, and then he's testing them in like every imaginable way, and he's collecting literally billions of data points on each of these patients. Mm-hmm. And he's looking for patterns. And he's found there's one thing in his son that was 16 standard deviations from normal.
Wow.
Which is
huge.
Really astonishing.
That may be the marker that will help to delineate this. Okay, so you
that's
have
exactly
a bone to pick with some of the researchers on the case with chronic fatigue syndrome. There was, and actually this is something that I covered recently in a blog, which has really made a splash because it's an example of fake news when it comes to science. Recently there was an article in one of the tabloids in New York, which said that most scientific studies are wrong, something that uh-huh. I affect. And, you know, this is actually a theme that's been raised, you know, many times recently, that scientific studies aren't what they're cracked up to be. There's a lot of scientific misconduct. If not scientific misconduct, that's willful. It's sloppy science. And so there was a trial called the PACE trial, which initially promised to offer hope to CFS patients. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the PACE trial came out in 2011, which was also when I was at my sickest. And I was reading the New York Times on my cell phone. I was too sick to sit up to use my computer. And I came across this headline that said, "Psychotherapy eases chronic fatigue syndrome, study says."
Hmm.
And I thought, psychotherapy? And I read the article, and the claim of the study was that gradually increasing exercise will help or even cure chronic fatigue syndrome patients, mm-hmm. and that you can either give them a program of graded exercise therapy, or you can give them psychotherapy that basically just encourages them to do the same thing,
mm-hmm.
and they will be just fine. And they claimed that 60% of patients improved and 22% recovered.
Mm-hmm. And this is the just do it theory of chronic fatigue syndrome.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, their theory was that patients had gotten a bad bug or something like that, and then they'd gotten out of shape.
Deconditioned.
And exercise,
yeah.
Exactly. Exercise didn't feel like it used to because they were out of shape. And then they just got this idea in their heads that they had this terrible disease, and so they didn't build up gradually the way they should have, and that caused all the symptoms. That was the idea of the mm-hmm. of the study, which didn't make any sense to me because when I first developed symptoms, that was exactly my thought. Was I yep. must somehow have yep. gotten out of shape, which made no sense because I had been building my house. I had been working incredibly hard, but I figured, okay, well, nevertheless, I just have to build up and get back in shape. And what I found was that exercise made me worse. And I got more and more modest in what I tried to do. And nevertheless, exercise just never seemed to be energizing the way it was before I got sick, even at very, very small amounts. So the study made no sense to me. And at the time, I was way too sick to take it on. But sometime later, then I did go through it in detail. And other patients had done this as well. And the problems were really shocking. So the most dramatic problem with it was after they started collecting data, they changed their minds about what they were going to call recovered. and they made it dramatically weaker. In fact, mm-hmm. they made it so much weaker that you could enter the trial, get worse on the two main measures of fatigue and physical function, and still be considered recovered. So you came into the trial, they said you were really disabled enough to enter it, you get worse, and they say now you're recovered. Mm-hmm. It's just completely astonishing.
But, you know, it's sometimes hard to pick out the obvious because buried in all the scientific terminology, the graphs, the charts, the data, you know, the average journalist is ill-equipped to discern that. So it's going to generate headlines, especially since most journalists don't actually read the studies. They read the press release and then they report uncritically.
That's exactly right. And actually, these researchers had kind of hidden their skullduggery well enough that I don't think it was possible for a journalist working on a deadline to, you know, within 3 hours, uncover what the problems were. You know, I think really was just not possible. You know, that said, much of the journalism on the study was truly terrible. I mean, worse than just what was kind of necessary because of the situation. And the really shocking thing for me as a science journalist was even when patients uncovered these huge problems, journalists ignored them for years. And what happened was the researchers struck back against patients. Yeah. And they had the story about how these crazy patients were prejudiced against psychiatry and had sent them death threats.
Yeah.
And a journalist actually told me that it all seemed too complicated, but that when he heard there were death threats, his sympathy was with the researchers and he just stopped.
In other words, chronic fatigue syndrome patients who were irate because of the study were depicted as crazies.
Exactly.
You know, and their complaints were invalidated because it was thought like, you know, these are just legitimate scientists. Why are you so mad? When actually there was legitimacy to their concerns about the way the study was performed. Anyway, the good news, all well that ends well, the study highly critiqued, eventually retracted, which is very unusual from the scientific journalists.
No, actually, no, it has not been retracted.
No?
The researchers are still defending themselves.
Okay.
However, at least the problems have been uncovered, and actually many scientists have signed an open letter to The Lancet demanding an investigation into it, and another letter demanding a retraction of a related paper.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
we'll see
remains,
what happens.
It remains in limbo, but at least it's been pointed out that there's some really serious inconsistencies. And I think the problem is that, you know, while there may be some merit to reconditioning programs for some small subset of patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, the problem is that the way they depicted it, it sort of delegitimizes the illness. It makes it seem like, oh, you know, it's just sort of a psychological funk that some patients get into, and it can be easily alleviated through simple behavioral methods. All right, I wish we could go on and on, but you know, people can do a deep dive into the subject and learn about your own personal journey through the Shadowlands. That's a great metaphor for the struggle that you underwent and the struggle that many CFS patients undergo in attempting to find answers. Sometimes the answers are breakthrough answers. Sometimes the answers just help with coping because it is a difficult and challenging disease. I don't want to minimize it. And your book by no means suggests that, you know, it's one of those panacea-like, you know, how-to books. But
right.
It's sincere and personal, and there's lots of great information there. What's our Intelligent Medicine take-home message? Where can people get a hold of this? And do you have a website as well?
I do. So the book is available, you know, basically everywhere. It's coming out May 23rd and is available for pre-order now. And my website is julieraymeier.com. That's J-U-L-I-E. And my last name is R-E-H-M-E-Y-E-R.com. Or you can go to the book's website at throughtheshadowlands.com.
I want to congratulate you on an accomplishment because you struggled through this. And while you may not have completely transcended it, You produced a work that obviously takes a lot of stamina, focus, and concentration, and I think it's going to help a lot of people. So congratulations.
Thank you
to
so
you
much.
On your at least seeming substantial success in overcoming a very challenging condition. And I think you're a shining example to patients who cope with this, that there is hope, that there can
Thank
be a
you
solution,
so much.
And there can be a healing yeah. path.
Yes.
Thanks very much for joining us. Julie Raymeyer, author of Through the Shadowlands. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.